work emergency. Poor thing. He's afraid he might miss the wedding.
As the Daimler chauffeuring Eddie, Fiona, and their three children approached the gates of 11 Nassim Road, Eddie did one last run-through.
Callista, what are you going to do when they start to serve the coffee and desserts?
I'm going to ask great Aunt Felicity whether I can play the piano.
And what are you going to play?
The Bach Partita and then the Mendelssohn. Can I also play my new Lady Gaga song?
Callista, I swear to God, if you play any of that damn Lady Gaga, I'm going to break every one of your fingers.
Fiona stared out the car window, ignoring her husband. This is how he was every time he was about to see his Singapore relatives.
Augustine, what's the matter with you? Button your jacket,
Eddie instructed. The little boy obeyed, carefully buttoning the two gold buttons on his blazer.
Augustine, how many times have I told you do not ever, ever button the last button? Do you hear me?
Papa, you said never button the last button on my three-button jacket, but you never told me what to do when there's only two buttons.
The boy whimpered, tearing up. Hop in now, Fiona said to her husband, taking the boy into her lap and gently smoothing out the hair on his forehead. Eddie gave her an annoyed look.
Now, everybody listen up. Constantine, what are we going to do when we get out of the car?
We are going to get into formation behind you and Mummy, his eldest son answered.
And what is the order?
Augustine goes first, then Callista, then me,
the boy droned in a bored voice.
Perfect. Wait till everyone sees our splendid entrance, Eddie said excitedly.
Eleanor entered the front hall behind her son and his girlfriend, eager to observe how the girl would be received. Nick had obviously been preparing her. Rachel was cleverly wearing a demure-looking navy blue dress and no jewelry except for tiny pearl earrings. Looking into the drawing room, Eleanor could see her husband's extended clan all clustered by the French doors leading out to the terrace. She remembered as if it were yesterday meeting them for the first time. It was at the old Sien estate near Changi, before the place was turned into that frightful country club all the foreigners went to. The Tian boys with their roving eyes were tripping over themselves to talk to her, but the Shangs barely deigned to look in her direction. Those Shangs were only comfortable speaking to families they had known for at least two generations. But here Nick was, boldly leading the girl straight into the frying pan, attempting to introduce Rachel to Victoria Young, the snottiest of Philip's sisters, and Cassandra Shang, the imperious gossip monger otherwise known as Radio One Asia.
A la Mac, this was going to be good.
Rachel, this is my Aunt Victoria and my cousin Cassandra, just back from England.
Rachel smiled nervously at the ladies. Victoria, with her wiry chin-length bob and slightly rumpled peach cotton dress, had the look of an eccentric sculptress, while whippet-thin Cassandra, with her graying hair severely parted into a tight Frida Kahlo bun, wore an oversized khaki shirt dress and an African necklace festooned with little wooden giraffes. Victoria shook Rachel's hand coolly, while Cassandra kept her spindly arms crossed over her chest, her lips pursed in a tight smile as she assessed Rachel from head to toe. Rachel was about to inquire about their vacation when Victoria, looking over her shoulder, announced in that same clipped English accent that all of Nick's aunts had.
Ah, here come Alex and Malcolm. And there's Eddie and Fiona. Good grief, look at those children all dressed up like that.
Alex was moaning on about how much money Eddie and Fiona spend on those kids. Seems they only wear designer clothes, Cassandra said, stretching out designer, as if it were some sort of grotesque affliction.
Gum sai chin, Victoria huffed.
Yes, such a waste of money when they will outgrow their clothes in no time, Cassandra agreed.
Where on earth does Eddie think he's taking them? It's 105 degrees outside and they are dressed for a shooting weekend at Balmoral, Victoria scoffed.
They must be sweating like little pigs in those tweed jackets, Cassandra said, shaking her head.
Just then, Rachel noticed a couple entering the room. A young man with the tousled hair of a Korean pop idol lumbered toward them with a girl dressed in a lemon yellow and white striped tube dress that clung to her body like sausage casing. Ah, here comes my cousin Alistair, and that must be Kitty, the girl he's madly in love with, Nick remarked. Even from across the room, Kitty's hair extensions, false eyelashes, and frosty pink lipstick stood out dramatically, and as they approached, Rachel realized that the white stripes in the girl's dress were actually sheer, with her engorged nipples clearly showing through.
Everyone, I'd like you all to meet my girlfriend, Kitty Pong, Alistair proudly beamed.
The room went dead silent as everyone stood gaping at those chocolate-brown nipples. While Kitty basked in the attention, Fiona swiftly herded her children out of the room. Eddie glared at his kid brother, furious that his entrance had been upstaged. Alistair, thrilled by the sudden attention, blurted out,
"And I want to announce that last night I took Kitty to the top of Mount Faber and asked her to marry me."
"We're engaged," Kitty squealed, waving around the large, cloudy pink diamond on her hand. Felicity gasped audibly, looking at her sister, Alex, for some reaction. Alex gazed into the middle distance, not making eye contact with anyone. Her son nonchalantly continued,
"Kitty, meet my cousin Nikki, my auntie Victoria, and my cousin Cassandra. And you must be Rachel."
Without missing a beat, Victoria and Cassandra turned to Rachel, cutting Alistair dead.
"Now, Rachel, I hear you are an economist. How fascinating. Will you explain to me why the American economy can't seem to dig out of its sorry state?" Victoria asked shrilly.
"It's that Tim Paulson fellow, isn't it?" Cassandra cut in. "Isn't he a puppet controlled by all the Jews?"
Chapter 3. Patrick's. Singapore.
"A lacy black thong, and you could really see it through the dress?"
Paiklin cried out, doubling over with laughter in the restaurant banquette she was sharing with Rachel.
"The thong, the nipples, all of it. You should have seen the look on all of their faces."
"She might as well have been naked," Rachel said. Paiklin wiped the tears of laughter from her eyes.
"I can't believe all that's happened to you in the past week. Those girls, the dead fish, Nick's family. Leave it to you to walk right into the middle of all this."
"Oh, Paiklin, I wish you could see how Nick's family lives. Staying at Tyrosol Park has been absolutely unreal. The bedroom we're in has all this exquisite French art deco furniture, and I feel like I've traveled back in time. The rituals, the decadence, the scale of everything. I mean, there must be at least 12 extra house guests in town for the wedding, but there are so many maids around, I still have one dedicated just to me. This cute girl from Suzhou, I think she's a bit pissed off because I haven't let her do all her duties."
"What are her duties?" Paiklin inquired.
"Well, the first night she offered to undress me and brush my hair, which I thought was a little creepy. So I said, no thanks. Then she asked if she could draw me a bath." I love that phrase, don't you? "But you know I prefer showers, even though the clawfoot tub looks amazing. So she offers to give me a shampoo and scalp massage. I'm like, no, I don't need that. I just want her to leave the room so I can take my shower." Instead, the girl rushes into the bathroom to adjust the old-fashioned shower taps until the water temperature is just perfect. I walked in, and there were like 20 candles lit all around the room. For a frickin' shower!
"A la mock, Rachel! Why didn't you let her give you the works? All this royal pampering is totally wasted on you," Paiklin chided.
"I'm not used to all this. It makes me uncomfortable that someone's entire job is to wait on me hand and foot. Another thing, their laundry service is amazing. Everything I wear is washed and pressed within a day of my wearing it. I noticed how fresh and wonderful all my clothes smelled, so I asked my maid what sort of detergent they used. She told me that everything is ironed with a special lavender water from Provence. Can you imagine? And every morning, she wakes us up by bringing a calling tray to the bedroom with tea for Nick, done just the way he likes it, coffee done just the way I like it, and a plate of these delicious cookies, digestive biscuits, Nick calls them. And this is before the huge buffet breakfast that's laid out, and always in a different part of the house.
The first morning breakfast was served in the conservatory. The next morning it was on the second floor veranda. So even going to breakfast is like a surprising treat every day.
Picklin shook her head in amazement, making a few mental notes. It was time to shake things up with the lazy maids at Villa Doro. They needed some new tasks. Lavender water in the irons, for starters. And tomorrow she wanted to have breakfast by the pool.
I tell you, Picklin, between all the places Nick has taken me and all the lunches, teas, and dinners we've had to attend, I've never eaten like this in my entire life. You know, I never imagined that there could be so many big events surrounding one wedding. Nick warned me that tonight's party is on a boat.
Yes, I read that it's going to be on Dato Taito Lui's new mega yacht. So tell me about the outfits you're planning to wear this weekend, Picklin said excitedly.
Outfits? I only brought one dress for the wedding.
Rachel, you can't be serious. Aren't there going to be numerous events all weekend?
Well, there's the welcome party tonight on the yacht, the wedding tomorrow morning, which will be followed by a reception, and a wedding banquet in the evening. And then there's a tea ceremony on Sunday. I brought this cute cocktail-length black and white dress from Reese, so I figure I can just wear it all day tomorrow. And
Rachel, you're going to need at least three outfits tomorrow. You can't be seen in the same dress from morning to night. And everyone is going to be decked out in jewels and ball gowns for the wedding banquet. It's going to be the grandest event of the decade. There'll be big-time celebrities and royalty there.
Well, there's no way I can compete with that, Rachel shrugged. You know that fashion has never really been my thing. Besides, what can I do about it now?
Rachel Chu, I'm taking you shopping.
Picklin, Rachel protested. I don't want to be running around some mall right now at the last minute.
A mall?
Picklin gave her a look of disdain. Who said anything about a mall? She whipped out her cell phone and speed dialed a number.
Patrick, can you please let me in?
It's an emergency. We need to do an intervention.
Patrick's atelier was a former shop house on Anxiang Hill that had been transformed into an aggressively modern loft, and it was here that Rachel soon found herself standing on a glowing circular platform in nothing but her underwear, a three-way mirror behind her, and an Ingo Morer dome light hovering above, bathing her in warm, flattering light. Sigur Rós played in the background, and Patrick, just Patrick, wearing a white lab coat over a dramatically high-collared shirt and tie, scrutinized her intently, his arms crossed with one index finger on his pursed lips.
"You're very long-waisted," he pronounced.
"Is that bad?" Rachel asked, realizing for the first time how contestants must feel during the swimsuit competition of a beauty pageant.
"Not at all. I know women who would kill for your torso. This means we can put you in some of the designers that normally wouldn't fit on very petite frames."
Patrick turned to his assistant, a young man in a gray jumpsuit with meticulously combed hair, and declared,
"Chuan! Pull the plum Balenciaga, the naked peach Chloe, the Giambattista Valli that just came in from Paris, all the Marquesas, the vintage Givenchy, and that Jason Wu with the deconstructed ruffles on the bodice."
Soon, half a dozen or so assistants, all dressed in tight black t-shirts and black denim, buzzed around the space with the urgency of bomb diffusers, filling it up with rolling racks crammed with the most exquisite dresses Rachel had ever seen.
"I suppose this is how all super wealthy Singaporeans shop?" she asked.
"Patrick's clients come from everywhere. All the mainland Chinese, Mongolian, and Indonesian fashionistas who want the latest looks, and many of the privacy-obsessed Brunei princesses. Patrick gets access to the dresses hours after they've walked the runways," Picklin informed her.
Rachel gazed around in wonder as the assistants began hanging the dresses on a titanium rod that was suspended 7 feet into the air, encircling the platform like a giant halo.
"They're bringing in way too many dresses," she remarked.
"This is how Patrick works. He needs to see different styles and colors around you first, then he edits. Don't worry, Patrick has the most impeccable taste. He studied fashion at Central St. Martin's, you know. You can be sure that the dresses he picks out won't be seen on anyone else at the wedding."
"That's not my worry, Picklin. Look, no price tags anywhere? That's always a dangerous sign," Rachel whispered.
"Don't worry about price tags, Rachel. Your job is to try on the dresses."
What do you mean? Picklin, I'm not letting you buy me a dress.
Shush.
Let's not argue about this, Picklin said as she held up a translucent lace blouse to the light.
Picklin, I mean it. None of your funny business here, Rachel warned as she thumbed through another rack.
A dress that was hand-painted with watery blue and silver flowers caught her eye.
Now this is to die for. Why don't I try this one on, she asked.
Patrick re-entered the room and noticed the dress Rachel was holding.
Wait, wait, wait. How did that Dries van Noten get in here? Chuan!
He yelled for his long-suffering aide-de-camp.
The dress is reserved for Mandy Ling, who's on the way right now. Her mother will kao-bei-kao-boo if I let someone else have it. And I can't deal with her bitching today.
He turned back to Rachel and smiled apologetically.
I'm sorry. That Dries is already spoken for. Now, for starters, let's see you in this oyster pink number with the pretty bustle skirt.
Rachel soon found herself twirling around in one stunning dress after another and having more fun than she ever thought possible. Picklin would simply ooh and ah over everything she put on, while reading aloud from the latest issue of Singapore Tattle. Expect private jet gridlock at Changi Airport and road closures all over the CBD this weekend as Singapore witnesses its own royal wedding. Araminta Lee weds Colin Koo at the First Methodist Church on Saturday at high noon with a private reception to follow at an undisclosed location. Mother of the bride, Annabelle Lee, is said to have planned every last detail, blowing northward of $40 million on the occasion. Although the creme de la creme guest list has been more closely guarded than North Korea's nuclear weapons program, don't be surprised to see royalty, heads of state, and celebrities such as Tony Leung, Gong Li, Takeshi Kaneshiro, Yu Sai Kan, Rain, Fan Bingbing, and Zhang Ziyi in attendance. It's rumored that one of Asia's biggest pop divas will perform, and bookies are taking bets on who designed Araminta's bridal gown. Be on the lookout for Asia's most glittering to come out in full force, like the Shaws, the Thais, the Mitals, the Megahartos, the Hong Kong and Singaporeans, assorted Ambanis, the David Tangs, the Lorient Limbs, the Taipei Plastics Chews, and many others too fabulous to mention. Meanwhile, Patrick would dash in and out of the dressing room making definitive pronouncements.
That slit is too high. You'll give all the choir boys erections wearing that one. Gorgeous. You were genetically engineered to wear a layer. Never, ever wear green chiffon unless you want to look like bok choy that got gang raped. Now, that looks stunning. That flared skirt would look even better if you were arriving on horseback.
Every outfit Patrick selected seemed to fit Rachel more beautifully than the last. They found the perfect cocktail dress for the rehearsal dinner and an outfit that could work for the wedding. Just when Rachel finally decided that, what the hell, she would splurge on one great designer ball gown for the first time in her life, Picklin summoned for a whole rack of dresses to be wrapped up.
Are you taking all those for yourself? Rachel asked in astonishment.
No, these are the ones that looked best, so I'm getting them for you, Picklin answered as she attempted to hand her American Express black card to one of Patrick's assistants.
Oh, no, you're not. Put that Amex card down, Rachel said sternly, grasping Picklin's wrist.
Come on, I only need one formal gown for the wedding ball. I can still wear my black and white dress to the wedding ceremony.
First of all, Rachel Chu, you cannot wear a black and white dress to a wedding. Those are mourning colors. Are you sure you're really Chinese? How could you not know that? Second, when was the last time I saw you? How often do I get to treat one of my best friends in the whole world? You can't deprive me of this pleasure.
Rachel laughed at the preposterous charm of her statement. Picklin, I appreciate your generosity, but you just can't go around spending thousands of dollars on me. Now, I have money saved up for this trip, and I will gladly pay for my own.
Fantastic. Go buy some souvenirs when you're in Phuket.
In the dressing suite at the other end of Patrick's atelier, two attendants were gingerly tightening the corseted bodice of a scarlet Alexander McQueen gown on Amanda Ling, still jet-lagged from having just stepped off a plane from New York.
It needs to be tighter, her mother, Jacqueline, said, looking at the attendants, who each held one side of the gold silk cord, hesitantly.
But I can hardly breathe as it is, Amanda protested. Take smaller breaths, then.
This isn't 1862, Mummy. I don't think this is actually supposed to be worn like a real corset.
Of course it is. Perfection comes at a sacrifice, Mandy. Which, naturally, is a concept you seem to lack any understanding of.
Amanda rolled her eyes.
Don't get started again, Mummy. I knew exactly what I was doing. Things were going just fine in New York until you forced me to fly back for this insanity. I was so looking forward to blowing off Araminta's silly wedding.
I don't know what planet you're living on, but things are not just fine. Nikki is going to propose to this girl any minute now. What was the whole point of my sending you to New York? You had one simple mission to accomplish, and you failed miserably.
You have no appreciation for what I've accomplished for myself. I'm part of New York society now, Amanda proudly declared.
Who gives a damn about that? You think anyone here is impressed to see pictures of you in town and country?
He's not going to marry her, Mummy. You don't know Nikki like I do, Amanda insisted.
Well, for your sake, I hope you're right. I don't need to remind you. Yes, yes, you've said it for years. You have nothing to leave me. I'm the girl. Everything has to go to Teddy, Amanda lamented sarcastically.
Tighter, Jacqueline ordered the attendants.
Chapter 4. First Methodist Church, Singapore.
Another security checkpoint? Alexandra Cheng complained, peering out the tinted window at the throngs of spectators lining Fort Canning Road.
Alex, there are so many heads of state here. Of course they have to secure the location. That's the Sultan of Brunei's convoy ahead of us. And isn't the Vice Premier of China supposed to be coming?
Malcolm Cheng said.
It wouldn't surprise me if the Lees invited the entire Communist Party of China, Victoria Young snorted in derision.
Nick had departed at the crack of dawn to help Colin prepare for his big day, so Rachel caught a ride with his aunts and uncle in one of the fleets of cars leaving from Tyersall Park. The burgundy Daimler finally arrived in front of First Methodist Church, and the uniformed chauffeur opened the door, causing the crowd crammed behind barricades to roar in anticipation. As Rachel was helped out of the car, hundreds of press photographers hanging off metal bleachers began snapping away, the sound of their frenzied digital clicks like locusts descending on an open field. Rachel heard a photographer yell to a newscaster standing on the ground,
"Who's that girl? Is she someone? Is she someone?"
"No, it's just some rich socialite," the newscaster snapped back.
"But look, here comes Eddie Cheng and Fiona Tung Cheng."
Eddie and his sons emerged from the car directly behind Rachel's. Both boys were dressed in outfits identical to their father's, dove gray cutaway jackets and polka dot lavender ties, and they flanked Eddie obediently while Fiona and Callista followed a few paces behind.
"Eddie Cheng, look this way, Eddie! Boys, over here!"
the photographer shouted. The newscaster thrust a microphone in front of Eddie's face.
"Mr. Cheng, your family is always at the top of the best-dressed lists, and you certainly didn't disappoint us today. Tell me, who are you wearing?"
Eddie paused, proudly placing his arms around his boy's shoulders.
"Constantine, Augustine, and I are in Gives and Hawks Bespoke, and my wife and daughter are in Carolina Herrera."
He grinned broadly. The boys squinted into the bright morning sun, trying to remember their father's instructions. "Look straight into the camera lens. Suck your cheeks in. Turn to the left. Smile. Turn to the right. Smile. Look at Papa adoringly. Smile."
"Your grandsons look so cute all dressed up," Rachel remarked to Malcolm.
Malcolm shook his head derisively.
"Hiya. 30 years I have been a pioneering heart surgeon, but my son is the one who gets all the attention for his bloody clothes."
Rachel grinned. These big celebrity weddings all seemed to be about the bloody clothes, didn't they? She was wearing an ice blue dress with a fitted blazer trimmed with mother-of-pearl discs all along the lapel and sleeves. At first, she felt rather overdressed when she saw what Nick's aunts were wearing back at Tyersall Park. Alexandra in a muddy green floral dress that looked like 80s Laura Ashley, and Victoria in a geometric pattern black and white knit dress. So much for Paik Lin's theory. That looked like something dug up from the bottom of an old camphor wood chest. But here, among all the other chic wedding guests, She realized that she had nothing to worry about. 888 guests had been invited, since the number 8 in Chinese sounds like the word for prosperity, and Rachel had never seen such a prosperous-looking crowd like this in the daytime, with the men sharply dressed in morning suits and the women styled to within an inch of their lives in the latest looks from Paris and Milan, many sporting elaborate hats or flamboyant fascinators. An even more exotic contingent of ladies arrived in iridescent saris, hand-painted kimonos, and intricately sewn kabayas. Rachel had secretly been dreading the wedding all week, but as she followed Nick's aunties up the slope toward the Gothic red brick church, she found herself succumbing to the festive air. This was a once-in-a-lifetime event, the likes of which she would probably never witness again. At the main door stood a line of ushers dressed in pinstripe morning suits and top hats.
"Welcome to First Methodist," an usher said cheerily. "Your names, please."
"What for?" Victoria frowned.
"So I can tell you which rows you'll be sitting in," the young man said, holding up an iPad with a detailed seating chart glowing on its screen. "What nonsense! This is my church, and I am going to sit in my regular pew," Victoria said. "At least tell me if you're guests of the bride or groom?" the usher asked. "Groom, of course," Victoria huffed, brushing past him.
Entering the church for the first time, Rachel was surprised by how starkly modern the sanctuary looked. Silver-leaf latticework walls soared to the stonework ceilings, and rows of minimalist blonde wood chairs filled the space. There wasn't a single flower to be seen anywhere, but there was no need, because suspended from the ceiling were thousands of young aspen trees, meticulously arranged to create a vaulted forest floating just above everyone's heads. Rachel found the effects stunning, but Nick's aunties were aghast.
"Why did they cover up the red brick and the stained glass? What happened to all the dock wooden pews?" Alexandra asked, disoriented by the complete transformation of the church she had been baptized in. "Aya, Alex, don't you see? That Annabelle Lee woman has transformed the church into one of her ghastly hotel lobbies," Victoria shuddered.
The ushers inside the church rushed around in utter panic since most of the wedding guests were completely ignoring the seating chart. Annabelle had been advised on the seating protocol by no less an authority than Singapore Tattle's editrix-in-chief, Betty Bao. But even Betty was unprepared for the ancient rivalries that existed among Asia's old guard families. She would not have known, for instance, that the Hoos should always be seated in front of the Os, or that the Queks would not tolerate any Ings within a 50-foot radius. Predictably, Dick and Nancy Tsien had commandeered two rows near the pulpit and were turning away anyone other than the Tsiens, Youngs, or Shangs. In rare exceptions, they were allowing in a few Leungs and Lin Wyatt. Nancy, in a cinnabar red dress and enormous matching feather-brimmed hat, gushed excitedly as Alexandra and Victoria approached.
"Don't you love what they've done? It reminds me of the Seville Cathedral, where we attended the wedding of the Duchess of Alba's daughter to that handsome bullfighter. But we're Methodists, Nancy. This is a sacrilege. I feel like I'm in the middle of the Catian Forest, and someone is about to shoot me in the back of the head," Victoria seethed.
Rosemary Tsien walked up the central aisle, escorted by her grandson Oliver Tsien and her granddaughter Cassandra Shang, nodding to people she knew along the way. Rachel could already tell by Cassandra's wrinkled nose that she did not approve of the decor. Radio One Asia slipped in between Victoria and Nancy and launched into the latest breaking news.
"I just heard that Mrs. Lee Yongqian is furious. She's going to talk to the bishop right after the service, and you know what that means. No more new library wing."
Oliver, who was nattily dressed in a cream-colored seersucker suit, blue check shirt, and yellow knit tie, slipped in next to Rachel.
"I want to sit next to you. You're the best-dressed girl I've seen all day," he declared, admiring the understated elegance of Rachel's outfit.
As the church continued to fill up, Oliver's running commentary on the arriving VIP guests had Rachel alternately mesmerized and in stitches.
"Here comes the Malay contingent. Assorted sultanas, princesses, and hangers-on. It looks like someone got lipo. Lord have mercy. Have you ever seen this many diamonds and bodyguards in all your life? Don't look now. I'm pretty sure that woman in the cloche hat is Faye Wong. She's an amazing singer and actress. Famously elusive.
the Greta Garbo of Hong Kong. Ah, look at Jacqueline Ling in that Azadina Leia. On anyone else, that shade of pink would look slutty, but on her, it looks drop-dead perfect. And see that really thin fellow with the comb-over being greeted so warmly by Peter and Annabelle Lee? That's the man everyone here wants to talk to. He's the head of China Investment Corporation, which manages the Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund. They have more than $400 billion in reserves. On the bride's side of the aisle, Daisy Fu shook her head in awe. The Lees got everyone, didn't they? The president and prime minister, all the Beijing top brass, Mrs. Li Yongqian, even Cassandra Shang flew back from London. And the Shangs never come to anything. 10 years ago, the Lees were fresh off the boat from mainland China, and look at them now. Everyone who's anyone is here today. Speaking of anyone, look who just walked in. Alistair Cheng and Kitty Pong, Nadine Shaw hissed. Well, she looks quite ladylike in that red and white polka dot dress, doesn't she? Carol Tai graciously offered. Yes, that ruffled skirt almost appears to cover her buttocks, Lorena Lim noted. A la Mac, let's see what happens when she tries to sit with the Youngs. Wow, so malu for them. Won't they be embarrassed? I bet she'll be thrown out of the row, Nadine said with glee. The ladies craned their necks to look, but much to their disappointment, Alistair and his new fiancé were greeted cordially by his relatives and ushered into the row. No such luck, Nadine. Those people are far too classy to make a public show out of it. But I bet you they are sharpening their knives in private. Meanwhile, that Rachel Chu looks like the Blessed Virgin compared to her. Poor Eleanor. Her whole plan is backfiring, Daisy sighed. Nothing is backfiring. Eleanor knows exactly what she's doing, Lorena said ominously. At that moment, Eleanor Young walked up the aisle in a gunmetal gray pantsuit that shimmered subtly, clearly delighting in the attention she was getting. She caught sight of Rachel and forced a smile. Oh, hello there. Look, Philip, it's Rachel Chu in another designer dress. Every time I see this girl, she's wearing something more expensive than the last time. My God, she must be draining Nikki's money market account. Did you and Nikki stay up late last night? I bet you kids really went wild after we old fogies left the Dato's yacht, didn't you? Philip asked with a wink. No, not at all. Nick needed to get to bed early, so we headed home soon after you left. Eleanor smiled stiffly. The cheek of this girl to call Tyersil Park home. Suddenly, a hush fell over the crowd. Rachel thought at first that the ceremony was beginning, but when she glanced to the back of the church, all she saw was Astrid leading her grandmother up the aisle. My God, Mummy's here, Alexandra gasped. What? You must be hallucinating, Victoria shot back, turning around in disbelief. Oliver's mouth was agape, and every head on the groom's side of the church was trained on Astrid and her grandmother. Walking a few discreet paces behind them were the ubiquitous Thai ladies' maids and several Gurkhas. What's the big deal? Rachel whispered to Oliver. You don't know how monumental this is. Su Yi hasn't been seen at a public function like this in decades. She doesn't go out to other people's events. People come to her. A woman standing in the aisle suddenly dropped into a deep curtsy at the sight of Nick's grandmother. Who's that woman? Rachel asked Oliver, mesmerized by the gesture. That's the wife of the president. She was born a Wong. The Wongs were saved by Su Yi's family during World War II, so they have always gone to great lengths to show their respect. Rachel gazed at Nick's cousin and grandmother with renewed wonder, both so striking as they made their stately procession up the aisle. Astrid looked immaculately chic in a majorelle blue sleeveless halter neck dress with gold cuff bracelets on both arms dramatically stacked all the way up to her elbows. Shang Suyi was resplendent in a robe-like dress of pale violet that possessed the most distinctive gossamer sheen. Nick's grandmother looks amazing. That dress. Ah, yes, that's one of her fabulous lotus fabric dresses, Oliver said. As in lotus flowers? Rachel asked to clarify. Yes. From the stem of the lotus flower, actually. It's an extremely rare fabric that's hand-woven in Myanmar and normally available only for the most high-ranking monks.
I'm told that it feels incredibly light and has an extraordinary ability to keep cool in the hottest climates.
As they approached, Su Yi was swarmed by her daughters.
Mummy, are you feeling okay? Felicity asked in a worried tone.
Why didn't you tell us you were coming? Victoria snapped.
Hiya! We would have waited for you,
Alexandra said excitedly. Su Yi waved away all the fuss.
Astrid convinced me at the last minute. She reminded me that I wouldn't want to miss seeing Nikki as a best man.
As she uttered those words, two trumpeters appeared at the foot of the altar to herald the arrival of the groom. Colin entered the main sanctuary from a side alcove, accompanied by Nick, Lionel Ku, and Mehmet Sabansi, all in dark gray morning suits and silvery blue ties. Rachel couldn't help but swell up with pride. Nick looked so dashing standing by the altar. The lights in the sanctuary dimmed, and through a side door appeared a crowd of blonde boys dressed in fawn-like costumes of wispy white linen. Each rosy-cheeked boy clutched a glass jar filled with fireflies, and as more and more tow-headed boys emerged to form two lines along both sides of the church sanctuary, Rachel realized there had to be at least 100 of them. Illuminated by the flickering lights from their jars, the boys began to sing the classic English song, "My True Love Hath My Heart."
I don't believe it. It's the Vienna Boys Choir. They flew in the fucking Vienna Boys Choir, Oliver exclaimed.
Aya, what sweet little angels, Nancy gasped, overcome with emotion by the haunting alto voices.
It reminds me of the time King Hassan of Morocco invited us to his fort in the High Atlas Mountains.
Oh, do shut up, Victoria said sharply, wiping tears from her eyes. When the song ended, the orchestra, hidden in the transept, launched into the majestic strains of Michael Nyman's Prospero's Magic. As 16 bridesmaids in pearl-gray Duchess satin gowns entered the church, each holding an enormous curved branch of cherry blossom. Rachel recognized Francesca Shaw, Wandi Megaharto, and a teary-eyed Sophie Koo among them. The bridesmaids marched in choreographed precision, breaking off in pairs at different intervals so that they were spaced equally apart along the length of the aisle. After the processional anthem, a young man in white tie stepped up to the altar with a violin in his hand. More murmurs of excitement filled the church as people realized that it was none other than Charlie Siem, the virtuoso violinist with matinee idol looks. Siem began to play the first familiar chords of Theme from Out of Africa, and sighs of delight could be heard from the audience. Oliver noted,
"It's all about that chin, isn't it? Clenched against the violin as if he's making savage love to it. That marvelous chin is what's making all the ladies cream their knickers."
The bridesmaids lifted their branches of cherry blossom high into the air, forming 8 floral arches leading up to the altar, and the front doors of the church flung open dramatically. The bride appeared at the threshold, and there was a collective gasp from the crowd. For months, magazine editors, gossip columnists, and fashion bloggers had speculated wildly over who might be designing Araminta's dress. Since she was both a celebrated model and one of Asia's budding fashion icons, expectations were high that she would wear a dress made by some avant-garde designer. But Araminta surprised everyone. She walked down the aisle on her father's arm in a classically inspired wedding dress designed by Valentino, whom she lured out of retirement to make precisely the sort of gown that generations of European princesses had gotten married in. The sort of gown that would make her look every inch the proper young wife from a very traditional, old-money Asian family. Valentino's creation for Araminta featured a fitted high-necked lace bodice with long sleeves, a full skirt of overlapping lace and silk panels that unfurled like the petals of a peony as she moved, and a 15-foot train. Giancarlo Giametti would later inform the press that the train, embroidered with 10,000 seed pearls and silver thread, took a team of 12 seamstresses 9 months to sew and featured a pattern replicating the train Consuelo Vanderbilt wore when she fatefully wed the Duke of Marlborough in 1895. Yet, even in its Baroque detail, the wedding gown did not overpower Araminta. Rather, it was the perfect extravagant foil against the stark, minimalist wonderland her mother had so painstakingly created.
clutching a simple bouquet of stephanotis, with only a pair of antique pearl drop earrings, the slightest hint of makeup, and her hair in a loose chignon, adorned with nothing but a circlet of white narcissus. Araminta looked like a pre-Raphaelite maiden floating through a sun-dappled forest. From her seat in the front row, Annabelle Lee, exultant in an Alexander McQueen dress of chiffon and gold lace, surveyed the faultlessly executed wedding procession and reveled in her family's social triumph. Across the aisle, Astrid sat listening to the violin solo, relieved that her plan had worked. In the excitement over her grandmother's arrival, no one noticed that her husband was missing. Sitting in his row, Eddie obsessed over which uncle could best introduce him to the chairman of the China Investment Corporation. Standing by the altar, Colin gazed at the ravishing bride coming toward him, realizing that all the pain and fuss over the past few months had been worth it.
"I can hardly believe it, but I don't think I've ever been happier," he whispered to his best man.
Nick, moved by Colin's reaction, searched the crowd for Rachel's face.
Where was she? Oh,
there she was, looking more gorgeous than she'd ever looked. Nick knew at that very moment that he wanted more than anything to see Rachel walk up that same aisle toward him in a white gown. Rachel, who had been staring at the bridal procession, turned toward the altar and noticed Nick gazing intently at her. She gave him a little wink.
"I love you,"
Nick mouthed back to her. Eleanor, witnessing this exchange, realized there was no more time to lose. Araminta glided up the aisle, sneaking occasional peeks at her guests through her veil. She recognized friends, relatives, and many people she had only seen on television. Then she caught sight of Astrid. Imagine, Astrid Leong was at her wedding, and now they would be related through marriage. But wait a minute, that dress Astrid was wearing? Wasn't that the same blue Gautier she had worn to Carol Tai's Christian Helper's fashion benefit 2 months ago? As Araminta reached the altar where her future husband awaited, with the Bishop of Singapore in front of her and the most important people in Asia behind her, one thought alone crossed her mind.
Astrid Leong, that damn bitch, couldn't even be bothered to wear a new dress to her wedding.
Chapter 5 Fort Canning Park, Singapore. As the wedding guests began filtering into the park behind First Methodist Church for the reception, more gasps of astonishment could be heard.
"What now?" Victoria grumbled.
"I'm so tired of all this ooing and ay-ay-ing. I keep thinking somebody is going into cardiac arrest."
But as Victoria passed through the gates at Canning Rise, even she was momentarily silenced by the sight of the great lawn. In stark contrast to the church, the wedding reception looked like an atomic explosion of flowers. 30-foot-tall topiaries in gigantic pots and colossal spirals of pink roses encircled the field, where dozens of whimsical gazebos festooned in striped pastel taffeta had been built. In the center, an immense teapot spouted a waterfall of bubbly champagne into a cup the size of a small swimming pool, and a full-string ensemble performed on what appeared to be a giant revolving Wedgwood plate. The scale of everything made the guests feel as if they had been transported to a tea party for giants.
"A la Max, someone pinch me!" Puan Sri Mavis Un exclaimed as she caught sight of the food pavilions,
where waiters in powdered white wigs and Tiffany blue frock coats stood at tables piled mountain high with sweets and savories. Oliver escorted Rachel and Cassandra onto the great lawn.
"I'm a bit confused. Is this supposed to be the Mad Hatter's tea party or Marie Antoinette on a bad acid trip?"
"Looks like a combination of both," Rachel remarked.
"Now, what do you suppose they're going to do with all these flowers once the reception ends?" Oliver wondered.
Cassandra stared up at the towering cascade of roses.
"In this heat, they will all be rotten within 3 hours. I'm told the price of roses spiked to an all-time high this week at the Alsmeer flower auction. Annabelle bought up all the roses on the world market and had them flown in from Holland on a 747 freighter."
Rachel looked around at the guests parading the floral wonderland in their festive hats, their jewels glinting in the afternoon sun, and shook her head in disbelief.
"Ollie,
How much did you say these mainlanders spent? Cassandra asked. 40 million, and for heaven's sake, Cassandra, the Lees have lived in Singapore for decades now. You need to stop calling them mainlanders. Well, they still behave like mainlanders, as this ridiculous reception proves. 40 million, I just don't see where all the money went. Well, I've been keeping a tally, and I'm only up to 5 or 6 million so far. God help us, I think the motherlode is being spent on tonight's ball, Oliver surmised. I can't imagine how they're going to top this, Rachel said.
Refreshments, anyone? A voice behind her said. Rachel turned around to see Nick holding 2 glasses of champagne.
Nick! She cried excitedly.
What did you all think of the wedding ceremony? Nick asked, gallantly handing drinks to the ladies.
Wedding? I could have sworn it was a coronation, Oliver retorted.
Anyway, who cares about the ceremony? The important question is, what did everyone think of Araminta's dress?
It was lovely. It looked deceptively simple, but the longer you stared at it, the more you noticed the details, Rachel offered.
Ugh, it was awful. She looked like some kind of medieval bride, Cassandra sniggered.
That was the point, Cassandra. I thought the dress was a triumph. Valentino at his best, channeling Botticelli's Primavera and Marie de Medici's arrival in Marseille.
I have no idea what you just said, Ollie, but I agree, Nick laughed.
You look so serious up there at the altar, Rachel remarked.
It was very serious business. Speaking of which, I'm going to steal Rachel away for a moment, Nick said to his cousins, grasping Rachel's hand.
Hey, there are children around. No hanky-panky in the bushes, Oliver warned.
A la marque, Ollie, with Kitty Pong here. I don't think Nicky's the one we need to worry about, Cassandra said dryly.
Kitty stood in the middle of the great lawn, staring in wonder at everything around her. Here at last was something worth getting excited about. Her trip to Singapore so far had been nothing but a series of disappointments. First of all, they were staying at that cool new hotel with a huge park on the roof, but all the suites were booked up and they were stuck in a lousy regular room. And then there was Alistair's family, who clearly weren't as rich as she had been led to believe. Alistair's auntie Felicity lived in an old wooden house with old Chinese furniture that wasn't even polished properly. They were nothing compared to the rich families she knew in China, who lived in huge newly built mansions decorated by the top designers from Paris, France. Then there was Alistair's mother, who looked like one of those dowdy family planning commission workers who used to come to her village in Shanghai to give advice about birth control. At last, they were finally at this fairy tale wedding reception where she could be surrounded by the creme de la creme of society.
"Isn't that fellow in the bow tie the chief executive of Hong Kong?" Kitty whispered loudly to Alistair.
"Yes, I believe it is," Alistair answered.
"Do you know him?"
"I've met him once or twice. My parents know him."
"Really? Where are your parents, by the way? They disappeared so quickly after the wedding, I didn't even get a chance to say hi," Kitty said with a little pout.
"I'm not sure what you're talking about. My dad's right there, piling his plate with langoustines, and my mum is over in that purple-striped gazebo with my grandmother."
"Oh, your Amma is here?" Kitty said, peering at the gazebo. "There are so many old ladies in there. Which one is she?"
Alistair pointed her out.
"Who is that woman talking to her right now? The one in the yellow headscarf, covered head to toe in diamonds?"
"Oh, that's one of my Ma's old friends. I think she's some sort of Malay princess."
"Ooh, a princess? Take me to meet her now,"
Kitty insisted, dragging Alistair away from the dessert tent. In the gazebo, Alexandra noticed her son and that strumpet, she refused to call her his fiancé, walking intently toward her.
"Hiya! Were they actually on their way here? Did Alistair not have the sense to keep Kitty away from his grandmother, especially when she was receiving Mrs. Li Yongqian and the Sultana of Borneo?" "Astrid, it's getting a bit crowded. Will you please tell the Sultana's bodyguards to make sure no one else is allowed in?" she whispered to her niece, her eyes darting frantically at Alistair and Kitty.
"Of course, Auntie Alex," Astrid said.
As Alistair and Kitty approached the gazebo, three guards in crisp military dress uniforms blocked the steps in front of it.
"Sorry, no more people allowed in," a guard announced.
"Oh, but my family's in there. That's my mother and grandmother,"
Alistair pointed, peering over the guard's shoulder. He tried to catch his mother's eye, but she seemed to be engrossed in conversation with her cousin Cassandra.
"Yoo-hoo!" Kitty cried out. She took off her huge polka-dotted straw hat and began waving it excitedly, jumping up and down. "Yoo-hoo, Mrs. Chang!"
Alistair's grandmother peered out and asked,
"Who is that girl jumping about?"
Alexandra wished at that moment she had put an end to her son's ridiculous romance when she'd had the chance.
"It's nobody, just someone trying to get a glimpse of Her Royal Highness," Astrid cut in, gesturing toward the Sultana.
"Is that Alistair with the jumping girl?"
Su Yi asked, squinting her eyes.
"Trust me, mummy, just ignore them," Alexandra whispered nervously.
Cassandra decided that it would be far more amusing to throw a wrench into this little charade.
"Aya, Auntie Su Yi, that's Alistair's new girlfriend," she said mischievously, as Alexandra glared at her in exasperation.
"The Hong Kong starlet you were telling me about, Cassandra? Let her in. I want to meet her," Su Yi said.
She turned to Mrs. Li Yongqian with a gleam in her eye.
"My youngest grandson is dating some Hong Kong soap opera actress."
"An actress?" Mrs. Li made a face as Alistair and Kitty were allowed into the gazebo.
"Ama, I want you to meet my fiancé, Kitty Pong," Alistair boldly announced in Cantonese.
"Your fiancé? Nobody told me you got engaged," Su Yi said, shooting her daughter a look of surprise.
Alexandra couldn't bear to make eye contact with her mother.
"So nice to meet you," Kitty said in a perfunctory tone, utterly disinterested in Alistair's elderly grandma.
She turned to the Sultana and dipped into a deep curtsy.
"Your Honor, it is such a privilege to meet you."
Cassandra turned away, trying to keep a straight face while the other ladies glowered at Kitty.
"Wait a minute. Are you the youngest sister in many splendid things?"
the Sultana suddenly asked.
"Yes, she is," Alistair proudly answered for her.
"Alamak, I love your show," the Sultana exclaimed. "My God, you are so evil. Tell me, you didn't really die in that tsunami, did you?"
Kitty grinned.
"I'm not telling you. You will just have to wait for next season." "Your gracefulness, your jewels are magnificent. Is that diamond brooch real? It's bigger than a golf ball."
The Sultana nodded her head in amusement.
"It's called the Star of Malaya."
"Ooh, can I touch it, Your Highness?" Kitty asked.
Mrs. Li Yongqian was about to protest, but the Sultana eagerly leaned forward.
"My God, feel the weight."
Kitty sighed, cupping the diamond in her palm.
"How many carats?"
118, the Sultana declared.
"One day, you buy me something just like this, won't you?"
Kitty said to Alistair unabashedly. The other ladies were aghast. The Sultana reached for her bejeweled handbag and pulled out an embroidered lace handkerchief.
"Will you please autograph this?"
she asked Kitty expectantly.
"Your majesticness, it would be my pleasure," Kitty beamed.
The Sultana turned to Shang Suyi, who had been surveying the whole exchange with bemused interest.
"This is your grandson's fiancée? How delightful! Be sure you invite me to the wedding."
The Sultana began to wiggle off one of the three humongous diamond rings on her left hand and handed it to Kitty as the ladies looked on in horror.
"Tania dan semoga kamu gembira selalu. Congratulations on your engagement. This is for you."
The farther Nick and Rachel walked from the great lawn, the more the park began to change. The strains of the string ensemble gave way to birds with strangely hypnotic chirps as they entered a pathway shaded by the sprawling branches of 200-year-old angsana trees. I love it over here. It's like we're on a whole other island, Rachel said, savoring the cool relief underneath the lush canopy.
I love it here, too. We're in the oldest part of the park, an area that's sacred to the Malays, Nick explained quietly. You know, back when the island was called Singapura and was part of the ancient Majapahit Empire, this is where they built a shrine to the last king.
The last king of Singapura. Sounds like a movie. Why don't you write the screenplay? Rachel remarked.
Ha, I think it'll draw an audience of about 4, Nick replied.
They reached a clearing in the pathway, and a small colonial-era structure covered in moss came into view.
Whoa, is this the shrine? Rachel asked, lowering her voice.
No, this is the gatehouse. When the British came in the 19th century, they built a fort here, Nick explained as they approached the structure and the pair of massive iron doors under the archway. The doors were wide open, flush against the inner wall of the tunnel-like gatehouse, and Nick slowly pulled on one of the heavy doors, revealing a dark, narrow entrance cut into the thick stonework, and beyond it the steps leading to the roof of the gatehouse.
Welcome to my hideout, Nick whispered, his voice echoing in the tight stairway.
Is it safe to go up? Rachel asked, assessing steps that looked like they hadn't been treaded on in decades.
Of course. I used to come up here all the time, Nick said, bounding up the steps eagerly. Come on.
Rachel followed gingerly, taking care not to rub any part of her pristine dress against the dirt-caked stairway. The roof was covered in freshly fallen leaves, gnarled tree branches, and the remnants of an old cannon.
Pretty cool, isn't it? At one point, there were more than 60 cannons lining the battlements of the fort.
Come, take a look at this, Nick said excitedly as he disappeared around the corner. Rachel could hear the schoolboy adventurer in his voice. Along the south wall, someone had scrawled long vertical lines of Chinese characters in what looked like a muddy brown color.
Written with blood, Nick said in a hushed voice.
Rachel stared at the characters in amazement. I can't make them out. It's so faded, and it's that old form of Chinese. What do you think happened?
We used to make up theories about it. The one I came up with was that some poor prisoner was chained here and left to die by Japanese soldiers.
I'm getting sort of creeped out, Rachel said, shaking off a sudden chill.
Well, you wanted to see the proverbial sacred cave. This is as close to it as you're going to get. I used to bring my girlfriends up here to make out after Sunday school. This is where I had my first kiss, Nick announced brightly.
Of course it is. I couldn't imagine a more eerily romantic hideout, Rachel said. Nick pulled Rachel closer. She thought they were about to kiss, but Nick's expression seemed to shift into a more serious mode. He thought of the way she looked earlier that morning, with the light streaming in through the stained glass windows and glinting on her hair.
You know, when I saw you in the church today, sitting with my family, do you know what I thought?
Rachel could feel her heart suddenly begin to race.
What?
Nick paused, gazing deeply into her eyes.
This feeling came over me, and I just knew that.
The sound of someone coming up the stairs suddenly interrupted them, and they broke away from their embrace. A ravishing girl with a short-cropped Jean Seberg hairstyle appeared at the top of the stairs, and behind her shuffled a portly Caucasian man. Rachel immediately recognized the hand-painted Dries von Noten dress from Patrick's atelier that the girl was wearing.
Mandy, Nick gasped in surprise.
Nico, the girl replied with a smile.
What are you doing here?
What do you think I'm doing here, silly rabbit? I had to escape from that tacky reception.
Did you see that ghastly giant teapot? I half expected it to get up and start singing in Angela Lansbury's voice, she said, shifting her gaze onto Rachel.
Great. Another Singapore girl with a posh English accent, Rachel thought.
Where are my manners? Nick quickly recovered. Rachel, this is Amanda Ling. You might remember meeting her mom, Jacqueline, the other night at Amar's.
Rachel smiled and extended her hand.
And this is Zvi Goldberg,
Mandy reciprocated. Zvi nodded quickly, still trying to catch his breath.
Well, I came up here to show Zvi the place where I received my first kiss. And would you believe it, Zvi? The boy who kissed me is standing right before us.
Mandy said, looking straight at Nick. Rachel turned to Nick with a raised eyebrow. His cheeks were bright red.
You gotta be kidding. You guys planned this reunion or something? Zvi cracked.
Swear to God, we didn't. This is a complete coincidence, Mandy declared.
Yes, I thought you were dead set against coming to the wedding, Nick said.
Well, I changed my mind at the last minute, especially since V has this fabulous new plane that can zip around so quickly. Our flight from New York only took 15 hours.
Oh, you live in New York too? Rachel inquired.
Yes, I do.
What? Has Nico never mentioned me to you?
Nico?